It's not easy being green.
Yep, that's Kermit the Frog, one of the many characters that sprang from the fertile mind of the late Jim Henson. With Sesame Street and The Muppet Show, Henson already had a special place in history. But his creations covered so much more territory. A traveling exhibition of Jim Henson's work opened this weekend at the Smithsonian International Gallery in Washington, D.C. It's called Jim Henson's Fantastic World. I got a private tour with curator Karen Falk. She's also the archivist of the Jim Henson Company.
Well, Jim was an interesting person in that he saved everything. He kept all of his artwork, his designs. He didn't go back to it very often, but he set it aside, figuring at some point somebody might be interested in taking a look at it. So we have a huge group of materials to choose from. It was difficult picking what was going to go in this exhibit.
And it's just as difficult figuring out where to start the tour. Colorful posters, scrawled ideas, and actual Muppets call out from every wall and every corner. But at the very front is perhaps the most famous Henson character of all, the fuzzy green frog himself.
But why wonder? Why wonder?
We couldn't represent Jim Henson and his creative thinking without having Kermit present. This is a Kermit the Frog puppet that Jim performed in the 1970s, and he really exemplifies Jim's role with his collaborators, sort of keeping all the crazies in order, but also causing a lot of the craziness himself. So it's really wonderful to have him represent Jim here in the exhibit.
Let's walk and look at some of the things here.
May I make a suggestion?
Who are you?
I'm LaCroix Dragon.
Yeah, a real dragon.
LaCroix Chow Mein is quick cooked by me in dragon fire.
Tell me where we're going now.
Well, something that a lot of people don't know about Jim Henson is in the, starting in 1957, he did a lot of work in television commercials. And throughout the 60s, he made hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of television commercials, starting with a local coffee company here in Washington, the Wilkins Coffee Company, making these 8-second commercials featuring Wilkins and Wonkins, a character, Wilkins, who was the company spokesman, and Wonkins, who won't drink the coffee. And then you can actually see the commercial on the video monitor here.
With this camera, I shoot pictures of people who don't drink Wilkins coffee.
I'm ready. Shoot.
Anybody else?
A lot of actors get their start in commercials, and something that people don't realize is a lot of Muppets got their start in commercials, too. And my favorite Muppet, Ralph the dog, is here.
Oh.
You may not know this, but I'm really a very sentimental dog.
And Ralph actually got started on a Purina dog chow commercial.
Oh, you're kidding.
I'm not kidding. Jim hired Don Celine, who was a well-known puppet builder, to work with him. Ralph became really the first nationally known Muppet. He was on the Jimmy Dean Show, which is a variety show, for 3 years in the early 60s. And was Jimmy Dean's old hound dog buddy. And he did sales films for IBM. He was the spokesdog for IBM in the 60s and was host of a summer replacement variety show in 67.
Wow.
And then ultimately, of course, people got to know him better as a singer and performer on The Muppet Show. And this particular puppet is from The Muppet Show era. It's not the original Ralph. It was made around 1976.
It's the Ralph I know.
It's the Ralph from The Muppet Show era.
When I think of Ralph, I think of the Muppet movie, the scene where he sings, "You can't live with him, you can't live with him."
That's the best scene because he's singing a duet with Kermit the Frog.
Yep.
And these are Jim's two alter egos, and they are performing together.
What are the two alter egos? What are the characteristics?
Well, I think Jim had a lot of himself in all of the characters he performed. But I think those are the two that really stand out. Kermit, for obvious reasons, in terms of being the leader of the group, and really sort of the idea man, but also concerned with the world and wanting to make the world a better place. I think that was very much Jim. Ralph is the more philosophical, fun, laid-back Jim Henson. Thought about the world, appreciated the world, and that's very much the Ralph side of Jim, I think.
All that he needs, a lassie, a lover and wife, gives you a new leash on life.
Was that a new leash on life?
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. 2, 3, 4.
Shall we move on?
Sure.
This looks like early Fraggle Rock.
Well, it's Menomina.
It's Menomina.
Are you going to sing
here,
it?
Here, let's do it.
You sing
I'll
it.
Do the Menomina. Manamana.
Do, 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 do.
Manamana. Do, 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 do. Manamana. Do, 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 do. Manamana. Do, 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 do.
They really exemplify the really crazy, fun, silly side of the Muppets.
What's that guy?
He's Manamana.
He's the Manamana. Okay, right. The guy who says that he's got green fur but orange crazy hair, furry, feathery hair, and looks like he's wearing a pair of shades. He's a cool guy.
He is a cool guy, and he's one of a lot of characters that Jim developed in the 1960s for variety show appearances. The Muppets were on the Ed Sullivan Show 25 times.
The youngsters have been sending in loads of mail asking me when we plan to have the Muppets back on our show. Well, I don't know exactly, so here they are now. The Muppets!
So further on, it looks like we're leaving Muppet.
Well, you know, during the 1960s, Jim really had sort of two career tracks going. He was doing his Muppets in commercials and variety shows, but he was also doing a lot of experimentation in film. In 1964, he made a short film called Timepiece, and Timepiece was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Short Film. On the video monitor, we have footage from the film, and then we've put next to the footage his storyboard frames that match the scenes he was shooting. He didn't write a script. There's no dialogue in the movie. It's all sound effects and music that goes with the images.
Let me just describe it a little bit. There's a doctor checking his heartbeat, of the heartbeat of the man. There's sort of an animation of the heartbeat, very interesting.
The man is Jim Henson.
He's tapping his fingers. He looks at the clock. A bird flies into the window. His heart is beating. Again, this animation of his heart beating. His eyes are blinking. He's tapping the book. It just seems like it's a montage almost of interesting, crazy shots.
It's something of a stream of consciousness idea of our struggle to find enough time to do everything. But it's very humorous, even though it's got sort of a serious message. But it's very funny to watch, as well as thought-provoking.
And listeners can check out a little bit of Timepiece on our website, npr.org.
And I think he was at a crossroads at the end of the 1960s. Which direction am I going with my career? Do I really focus on the Muppets? Do I really focus on the experimental film? And I think he might have been leaning toward the experimental film work. But then he got a call about coming to a meeting to talk about a new show called Sesame Street.
Sunny day, sweeping up clouds away.
Let's go in and see this. What is this video here?
At the end of the show, we have a 20-minute sort of a overview of Jim's career, but we wanted to present it in Jim's voice, give him a chance to tell you about his work.
I've always loved this show. I've loved being a part of it from the very beginning, and it was something that during the 70s, I suppose, the whole country felt it was slightly in a depression, you know, and emotional type of depression. And when you were working for the preschool kids, like the fives, four, five, six-year-olds, you can't be depressed about that. I mean, you know, this is such a wonderful age, and it's this wonderful innocence that you're dealing with. So I love doing all of that for all of those years.
It's eerie hearing his voice because, you know, he's been... I remember when he died. It was a blow to culture, and a lot of, especially for those of us who grew up with Sesame Street. And his voice is, you know, modulated into Kermit. It's all these important voices in our young lives. It's kind of touching and sad to hear him.
Well, I think that it's also a celebration of Jim. Jim left us with so many wonderful characters and so many fond memories and experiences, and his characters continue to live on. You can turn on new Sesame Street episodes every year. His company continues to make new programming. So I think that it's really exciting to be able to present him to a new generation of fans, not just the work, which they continue to see on television, but also the man and what he had to say about how we face the world and how we present ourselves in a fun, creative, celebrational way, really.
Karen Falk, the curator of Jim Henson's Fantastic World, thank you very much.
Oh, well, thanks for coming.
Why are there so many songs songs about rainbows and what's on the other side.
The exhibit runs through October here in Washington, then it's off to Atlanta and across the rest of the country.
Back now with Day to Day. The Blue Man Group has wowed audiences from Las Vegas to Amsterdam. Some 12 million fans have seen the show. It's three men, painted blue, pounding on white PVC pipes. The variety act began with just three guys, but as the show has expanded, so has the need for more blue men. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN reports on what it takes to become one.
Blue man casting directors know potential when they see it.
We're just going to check out your drumming.
My drumming skills.
Yeah.
Okay. At an open call in Nashville, a would-be blue man stands across from a drumming instructor. A practice pad mounted on a chrome stand separates them.
Okay, I'm gonna speed up.
During the exercise, the other directors size him up, looking to see if he meets the height range of 5'10 to 6'1, athletic build. One whispers, too skinny.
That's all for me. Thank you.
Okay. That was simple as all get up. Thanks.
Thank you very much. We'll be making calls tonight to anyone that we want to see again.
Okay. Karen Rockauer says casting a show like the Blue Man Group is tricky. The concept itself is nearly impossible to explain.
We often describe the character as being a combination of someone's inner child and their inner hero. If you combine those two elements of yourself and remove your ego, that's your blue man.
Okay. The show consists of three guys with heads painted blue. The trio bang on pipes and drums and play with light and paint, all to a rocking soundtrack. They appear to be discovering everything around them, like cavemen.
You don't have to do a lot as a blue man. It's very, very simple. It's about what's going on internally for you, if you're connected to your, what we call an internal story.
My name is Tanner Jacobson, and I am here today pursuing a 12-year-long dream.
Jacobson tried out to be a blue man after seeing a show in New York. He was 18. The casting director said, go get a degree. He did one better. He got two and started on a PhD.
And now I'm back with a vengeance. Ready to be blue for life.
Jacobson has been drinking. The blue Kool-Aid, that is.
It seems like the purest form of performance art you can possibly have, because all vanity, all the aesthetic is removed. You're completely concealed. It's an egoless, sexless character, and all he wants to do is create.
At callbacks, where reporters weren't allowed, casting directors wanted to see if the blue man wannabes had this and if they could tell a story with their eyes. They told 19-year-old Jesse Baker, a drummer by day, special effects artist by night, to respond to a few words with his face.
The first word was like, wow. So of course your first expression is, you know, you're almost like in shock, wow. But then it gets a little deeper and you're just like, wow.
It's like so subtle. But blue man Josh Elrod says physical storytelling is key to the show's global success.
People from every country in the world have come through New York and all laughed at the same moment.
Like when he catches 30 marshmallows in his mouth, a talent shared by all blue men.
So did you come into this thing being able to catch stuff in your mouth?
I did not, no. It's like the magic of showbiz, right? You're like, how do they do that? And then you very quickly learn, oh, it's just a lot of practice.
That's what Blue Man Boot Camp is for. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
The current number one song on the Billboard pop charts celebrates teenage makeout sessions. Nothing unusual about that, but Katy Perry's song is about same-sex smooching. It's called I Kissed a Girl. Youth Radio asked around to see what teenagers are making of the song.
I've kissed girls and I've liked it, and it opened a dialogue, at least with my roommates and I, about kissing girls, and it turned into like, you know, oh, what girls have you kissed? And yeah, I like girls and I'm attracted to girls too, but overall we would end up with boys, like to marry and be normal with boys, I guess.
The media portrays women on women as like girls can kiss other girls, and it's like, oh, we're not in love, we're just kissing, it's nothing.
The
fact that it is so edgy, but it is still the number one song, I think means that this is a common feeling among, I guess, girls or women wanting to experiment with someone of the same sex.
Apparently, I have dated a girl that was bisexual. So I was pretty hurt. I was pretty confused. Then once again, I was excited. And then I got back to mad.
For some people nowadays, being lesbian is a trend.
Being bi is a trend more often. Because I find girls, like, I mean, I've known them all my life, and they've been straight. And they're like, oh, I'm bi now. And I'm like, oh, when did you decide this? Like, I don't understand.
I'm not really attracted to girls, but I really like the song because it's got a good beat. You can dance to it. This song, along with a lot of the other songs that have been number one in the past, just cheesy pop songs, no one's really listening to what it says.
I kissed a girl and I liked it. Da, 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 da.
We heard from Sarah Catherman, Skylar Bryant, Sarah Wilder, Danielle Sender, Marcellus Campos-Reese, Asada Harris, and Shiwanel Tutashula. That story came to us from Youth Radio.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
For bibliophiles who like the feel of books and the look of the printed word on the page, the advent of the electronic book has been greeted with a fair amount of skepticism. So far, no electronic reader has overtaken the book, but Amazon's Kindle has been causing a stir. It was released last fall and may now be facing its ultimate test, summertime, and the ravages of sun, sand, and water. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
At Book Expo, the book industry's annual convention held this year in L.A., there was a palpable buzz of curiosity about the Kindle. Not only did Amazon founder Jeff Bezos fill a ballroom for a presentation extolling the virtues of the reading device, but on the convention floor, people who had never seen a Kindle were eager to get a look at it, or in my case, to get my hands on it.
Can I feel it? Yeah. Can I see what
you can,
it feels like?
You can put your hands all over my lovely Kindle.
It's very light, isn't it? Ooh, yes. I just did something.
Yep.
What I did was inadvertently touch the button that takes you to the next page. It's easy to do because the button is big. It runs along the side of the screen and is almost as long as the Kindle itself. According to Jay Marine, that was a deliberate design choice. Marine is director of product management for the Kindle.
We have very prominent page-turning buttons because when you're reading a book and you're sitting down, you don't want to be thinking about where the page-turn button is. You want to get lost in the story, which was the total goal of our design. And so by making that seamless where you can put your hands anywhere, when you're reading a book, you really come to appreciate that.
But is it really possible to lose yourself when reading a book on an electronic device? Sure, the Kindle is light, about the weight of a paperback, and slim. It would fit into most bags easily. But under the screen are a bunch of buttons, similar to the keys on a computer. And I can't help thinking, wouldn't all those buttons get in the way of a good read? And what if you get sand or water on them? Not a problem, according to Marine.
We like to say it's sort of like treat it like your BlackBerry or other device. I would definitely take it to the beach, but I wouldn't bury it.
Marine says they're pretty sure a little sand won't hurt the Kindle because they've done a lot of testing on it.
We knew people were going to throw it in their bag, they're going to drop it, they're going to take it to the beach. Like, it has to work where you want to read. You know, we haven't solved the problem of being underwater and reading with it, but we're going to work on that one.
Okay, that sounded like a challenge. So I took the Kindle to the neighborhood pool on a hot summer day.
Woohoo! Ah, what a wonderful day.
I was joined by Rob Pegoraro, who writes about technology and reviewed the Kindle for The Washington Post. His Kindle was snuggled between the covers of a brown leather-like case.
So that makes it feel a little bit more like a book, huh?
It probably counts as pleather, actually. I don't think it's actual leather.
Pegoraro says the Kindle, like the Sony Reader, its main competitor, is actually quite easy to read outdoors because it's not backlit and uses a kind of technology that makes the screen readable in direct sunlight. But the Kindle's big advantage over other electronic readers is that it's the only one with wireless capability. That allows readers to download books, newspapers, and magazines from Amazon pretty much anywhere at any time. Amazon currently has 125,000 titles available for downloading onto the Kindle and will convert others for a fee. Rob Pegoraro scrolls through a couple of the titles on his. Let's
see, we've got a copy of The Great Gatsby and a copy of Michael Lewis's Moneyball, the book about baseball and statistics.
Let's go to The Great Gatsby.
Yeah.
Pegoraro read The Great Gatsby on his front porch, and while he did manage to forget he was reading it on an electronic device, he also encountered a few problems. Hitting those page-turning buttons by accident was one of them. And when he wanted to go back and reread something, it wasn't easy.
If you can see, the screen is a little bit slow. I'm pressing the previous page button, and it flashes, and then I'm back. That's fine for going one page at a time as you're reading. But if you want to go back two chapters to see, okay, you know, what did Daisy first say when they met, you're sort of waiting. You can also do a search, which can be a little easier. Let's see, where is the search function on here?
Well, while Pegoraro was tracking down his search function, I decided to go for a swim.
Okay.
A few minutes later, back on the side of the pool, I was ready to explore the Kindle on my own.
All right, so I'm still dripping.
Here you are.
I'm still dripping, but I just pushed that turning page button by mistake, and I'm dripping on it. Is that a problem? Look.
Pegoraro assured me a few drops won't hurt the device, but looking around the poolside, he assessed the threats to the electronic reader, and a lot of water is one of them.
This is not water resistant so far as I know. I haven't put it to that test yet. There's concrete underneath this, so that inside this case, it's probably all right if I dropped it just a few inches, but I wouldn't play catch with it.
Is it sturdier or more durable than other kinds of technology that somebody might bring to a pool, like a cell phone, for instance, let's say?
I think it's probably about the same level of durability. In some ways, it has more moving parts. The screen is certainly, this is an unusual kind of electronic paper screen. I don't want to know what it costs to fix.
Pegoraro's pleather case provides some protection, and one young woman I talked to said she puts her Kindle in a Ziploc bag to protect it from water, dirt, and especially suntan lotion. Damaging a Kindle would be costly. The device sells for $360. That price tag was one of the things that put off Beau Marshall. He was sitting nearby reading a book, so we asked him to take a look at the Kindle. Marshall was impressed by the device, but said he probably wouldn't buy one.
The electronics is great if it were virtually free, you know. And if you're raised with them, I understand the kids and the younger generations would probably prefer that. But being rather retro, to put it charitably, I would probably prefer, all things being equal, the printed page.
The Kindle, says Pegoraro, may be beating the competition at the moment, but it still has a way to go before it changes the way most of us read.
They've still got some learning to do with designing gadget interfaces. It's not quite the iPod of e-book readers.
But if the Kindle isn't the future, you can see it from here. A better, cheaper product is sure to come along. And when it does, we may all be reading the classics electronically.
All right, so maybe I should settle back and read The Great Gatsby now. Soak up a little sun.
Off the road!
Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.